Under the Radar to me means authenticity, not being filtered.
It's a window in on the local stories that touch our lives.
And there's a huge void in the traditional media covering this new faces of Boston.
You may not be looking for a particular story, but when you hear about it, you're engaged.
Under the Radar means ahead of the curve.
It's also perspectives. How does this particular story affect a community or a neighborhood?
I'm Callie Crossley. This week, Under the Radar, a broad look at the future of Boston. Will a new Boston emerge in this new year and with new leadership in City Hall? Are there factors both on and off the front burner that are critical to the success of a fresh start and a new direction? Later in the show, Lanyap, our Something Extra segment. Most of us are familiar with the Boston accent. We drop our R's, use broad A's, and go to the Packy to get tonic. Now, Spanish speakers in Boston are beginning to form their own Boston accent, merging several Spanish dialects. We'll talk about how and why it's happening and what it means. But first, joining me to kick off our Future of Boston conversation is Malia Lazu, founding executive director of the Future Boston Alliance. Thanks, Malia. Hi, how are you?
Hi. Good. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Listen, your organization's title says it all, Future of Boston, and you've been working in that direction from the beginning. I want to point out that two of the things that you have advocated for your organization, Future Boston Alliance, are going to be reality now. We're going to have some tea service that goes later, and it looks like the liquor license expansion, the home rule petition, which was sponsored by City Councilor Ayanna Pressley, is going to go through and get signed by the mayor. So those are two big initiatives that your organization has been pushing for. What is the impact of those two accomplishments, moving Boston to the Boston of the future?
Well, you know, we're really excited about these two moves that, happened both at the city and state level for Boston, because they will have some real significant impact. I mean, I think for the tea and the late night service, this is just going to be a test run. We want to make sure that we are supporting late night service. And, you know, if you're going into town, you can take the tea now, and we want to encourage all of that happening. But what we hope to see with it is, you know, we hope to see a Boston that enjoys itself a little more, that doesn't feel like it's always under the gun of needing to get on the train by a certain time. But also there's a lot of people who work at night, who work overnight, and it's going to be encouraging, I think, for them to be able to go get home in an affordable way.
And the expansion of the liquor licenses, which seems like it's going to be a done deal.
Yes, it does. And I mean, I really hope it does. We're not, we're not asking for something that we're already awash in. I mean, Boston ranks 119th. This is a stat from the Boston Globe, ranks 119th in the state for liquor licenses per capita. We're the only city whose liquor licenses are not tied to population. And I think that, you know, it's unfair. It's unfair for neighborhoods who want to build a restaurant culture. A lot of neighborhoods, you don't want to be filled with chain stores and banks, but, you know, maybe have places for you to go to meet your neighbors. We at Future of Boston believe that it's in those places of intersection that ideas come and innovation happens and partnerships are built, both personally and professionally. So once we, once we get through the State House and it's officially a done deal, I think the most important thing is going to be encouraging entrepreneurs, chefs, and small business owners to embrace this and start opening restaurants.
So, Malia, you specifically, in representing your organization, have really talked beyond those two specific things. I did want to get those on the table. You've been advocating for a big conversation, a kind of community dialogue, which I will note that you wrote about in November of last year. And recently, Scott Lehigh has a column in which he says essentially what you've been saying is that there has to be, in this moment of transition to a new mayor and other things changing, for us to go in a direction of a future of Boston in any way, a big conversation. Now, why is that important? And more importantly, how does it happen?
I am so happy that you asked those two questions, because it is one of those things that, you know, you can go a lifetime without doing. And I think anyone who's been in a long-term relationship with family or friends or anyone knows that those big conversations are important. That taking stock in what you believe in and where you want to go and what you want to see is very important, you know. And I think now we have the technology and you know, some great organizational theory that really gives us the tools to be able to do it at a much larger level. You know, and listen, this isn't easy, but it's also not rocket science, right? I mean, if you think about your relationship with society, the way you think about any other relationship, you know, it does take work, but it's work worth doing. And I think that's what we're really, you know, calling for. And I was really happy to actually see Scott's column today, because I thought, you know, the more that we can push this, that the more important or the easier it will be for it to happen. So, you know, I think what it looks like and how it happens should be at many different levels and should be really decentralized. You know, it was nice to see the model that de Blasio sort of put out in New York, which was, you know, these tents and you could come in and, you know,
that's the new mayor of New York, by the way, for people who are not paying attention.
Yes.
Bill de Blasio.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
Go ahead.
The new mayor of New York.
Uh-huh.
You know, but it was still this very much, you know, go and ask the power, right, for things. And I think we at Future Boston, you know, we like to see these discussions that our new mayor-elect has been doing. And the more that we can encourage these types of things, and I think, you know, using the arts are important. Lisbon did this really incredible citywide conversation using Post-it notes around participatory budgeting, and they had people submit on a Post-it note what they would want money to be spent on, you know, everything from like more benches to more stop signs to, you know, overhauling an education system. And then they had an artist build this beautiful mural of the Post-it notes and you know, and then compile them into a report to give to the council there. So there's a lot of creative things that we can do. And, you know, if there's one thing that Boston has is brains and creativity. And, you know, going to the our artists who are here and our innovators who are here and our you know, activists and people who are working in government, I think if we could all come together, we could really figure out some amazing ways to help Boston have this conversation. You know, and I guess the last thing I would like to say is I think that as we move forward, we don't want to make it seem like we're leaving something behind. You know, there's this great concept called Sankofa, and it literally means go back and get it. But I think, you know, as we talk about evolution, the great thing about evolution is you keep what works. Right. And so that's, you know, we also want to be careful that we're not throwing out the baby with the bathwater, but that we're keeping what works.
Well, thank you so much, Malia, so much for just kicking off our conversation about the future of Boston. And I'm going to be looking for the Future Boston Alliance to begin pushing for that civic conversation.
Yes. And thank you so much, because you're a great space and support for all of this work happening in Boston, Kylie. We're really blessed to have your show.
All right. Thank you. Malia Lazu is the founding executive director of the Future Boston Alliance. And now joining me to continue our look into Boston's future is Marcela Garcia, a special correspondent at Telemundo Boston and a contributing writer for the Boston Business Journal and the Boston Globe. Hi, Marcela.
Hi, Callie. Thank you for having me today.
Of course. And also with me, Gin Dumptious, news editor at the Dorchester Reporter. Hello, Gin.
Hey, how are you?
Good to get to hear from you. And Shirley Leong, business columnist and associate editor at the Boston Globe. Welcome, Shirley.
Thank you.
All right. So let's continue our conversation. Malia has set the table for us, Malia Lazu from the Future Boston Alliance. Each of you have sort of pinpointed a couple of things that need to happen so that Boston can move from wherever it is today, as one might see it, into a new Boston, if you will. Let me start with you again, because, You did a sort of comprehensive piece about the import of the lack of appointments at this moment by Mayor-elect, soon-to-be Mayor Marty Walsh. He's not named anybody. He promised he would before Christmas. It hasn't happened. There are reasons for that, and I think he wants to be very careful, as he said. But what's the impact of his not doing it? My sense is that what that leaves him with, maybe some pressure to get people who've already done these jobs as opposed to maybe somebody who might be new in them.
Right. What he's been telling reporters and others is that to expect a lot of temporary appointments in the next few weeks, he wants to take his time. His crew believes that they want to vet the new people they'll be bringing in. They'd rather take their time and get slammed for that instead of making an appointment and getting hit with something negative they hadn't uncovered in their search process.
Okay, now it could get a little sticky because it was noted that the snow removal czar Elmo Baldassarre, his last day is last Friday. That's it. He's gone. So,
right.
As you know, we're in the middle of the snow season. Seems like that's a critical appointment.
Absolutely. As is chief of staff, everything starts with the chief of staff and the incoming mayor. The reason he says that he's taking so long with it is because he wants to find someone he can click with. He'll be spending the most amount of time every single day with him. And he's taking his time with that. The problem is that creates a backlog, replacing the snow czar and others, because it starts with the chief of staff.
I'm surprised that he's taken this long. I mean, I can understand not appointing, 50 department heads, but he should at least do a dozen or so. I mean, one thing that business community doesn't like is uncertainty, and there's already going to be uncertainty with the new mayor, and now we're going to have even more uncertainty because now we're going to have probably interim department heads on top of. New department heads. So it would have been nice to see a few appointments, I think.
You're listening to Shirley Young, my guest, a business columnist for The Globe and also associate editor. Shirley, are you concerned then? Because it would seem to me that the easier way out of this would be to get people who've already done the job. Would that leaves less room for people who might not have done the job, but who have the portfolio skills to do it, because you don't want to take that risk?
Okay to have, I mean, people who are in the Menino administration who are doing a good job, I think it's okay to keep them there, some of them, not all of them. I mean, yes, change is good, but you don't have to, you don't have to blow up the BRA, right? That was a mantra on the campaign trail, blowing up the BRA. And now, Marty Walsh said, I don't want to do that right away. I want to take a wait-and-see attitude and just kind of get a little more, get a sense of what's going on first. And so, I think it's okay to have some reappointments.
Shirley, while you're talking about the BRA, and I'm going to circle back to these appointments, Marcel, in just a second, so I want you to weigh in on it. If you don't blow up the BRA, as he said, he's not going to do it. He sort of had maybe given some hint he might do it on the campaign trail, but changed his mind. That suggests a sort of everything stays the same in terms of big business development. You've said that business doesn't like uncertainty, so wouldn't it be easier to just sort of go along with the plan that Menino had left and maybe not do some of the things that people who are very critical of the way that the BRA has been influential in this city would like to see some changes happen there, and it won't then if it's business as usual?
Well, I think Marty has said that he doesn't want to blow up the BRA, but he definitely wants changes. I mean, he wants the BRA to be more transparent and to be more efficient. He has been one of these people in his previous job as the head of the Labor Council. He's attended a lot of BRA meetings, talking about the union jobs and associated with some of the construction projects there, but that go before the BRA. And, so he has said that he thinks development process takes too long here and it's too murky. He believes that when someone proposes to build something, it should take roughly 3 years. From beginning to end. And that seems like a reasonable time frame. A lot of the big projects here can take a decade.
Or more,
can miss economic cycle, financial cycles as a result and financing as a result. So he is for change, but I do like the fact that he's more measured about it. I think it's too easy for a new mayor to come in to be like, I'm going to do everything my way or in vastly different from Menino. But I think if there are things that work and keep some of those things in place and then make your own adjustments.
So, Marcella, that's Shirley Leung. Marcella Garcia, you're very concerned about Marty Walsh coming through on his promises around diversity. And most importantly, you said it cannot be tokenism. So here we have
one
big organization that a lot of folks had hopes for, BRA, might be headed by somebody who's a person of color. I don't know if that's going to happen. But more to the point, while he's temporarily assigning all of these other positions, folks are looking very carefully to see if that diversity promise is going to be fulfilled.
Absolutely. He obviously was very generous with his promises during the campaign, saying that and pledging that his administration would reflect the diversity of Boston. And I think at some point he pledged to have at least 50% of the top positions in his administration filled by Blacks, Latinos, and Asians, which again remains to be seen. I do see the fact that he's taking some time in appointing his top people in the administration as a good sign. I think, change doesn't happen overnight and it takes a while. And I think, like Shirley was saying, he's probably realizing that he cannot just come in and immediately change everything. And of course, you got to remember that Menino took his time as well. And he didn't become Menino overnight. He wasn't the Menino that we know now when he started. So I think I do see it with hopeful signs that he's taking his time. In the issue of diversity, I know that there are groups that are going to be watching and making sure that his appointments do not reflect just a symbolism or tokenism, as you were saying. I think those hires that he or those appointments that he makes that are people of color, they have to translate into opportunities and access for minorities in Boston. I mean, this is a city that has 53% of residents that identify as a race other than whites. And then if you look at, for example, the Boston Public Schools, then the issue gets even more grave in terms of the disparities that you see between the student body and the teachers. So again, taking his time might be a good time, but I know that his appointments or his people of color appointments are going to be met with very critical eyes in the city.
So Marcella, just to follow up on that, Marcella Garcia, special correspondent for Telemundo and contributing writer to the Boston Business Journal and the Boston Globe. There is this organization called the Boston Inclusive Alliance, and they've given him some time deadlines, 100 days in office, 6 months, a year, 2 years. But it's not, they haven't been quite clear about what exactly would indicate a change or the fact that he's been accountable. In your mind, what needs to happen for there to be clear evidence of his being accountable to his promise?
Well, I think what needs to happen is that it's clear that he's obviously going to appoint people of color. I mean, that's something that we can all agree on, I guess. The question remains where and what department or what department head he's going to be appointing people of color to. And so I think that's the key question. We have to make sure that those appointments are made in positions that are going to have a clear impact, the BRA or the Department of Housing, or you know what I mean? Like not, and that's where the tokenism comes in. Just don't just name somebody because you have to fill a quota. And then again, I think that having named this transition team, Travagor, Richie, Felix Arroyo, and John Barros, makes a difference. I think that's where they come in. They're going to be making sure, it is my hope, and you would assume, that they're going to make sure that his appointments are made in key positions. You know, positions in real power, in positions that would have an impact in all these areas, education, the fire department, the police commissioner too. You know, so that is where the difference is going to be made, I think.
I worry about, you know, how Marty is, and this is something that both Ginn and Marcella raised, is I worry about how Marty is he setting unrealistic expectations for himself. I think it's great that he wants his cabinet to reflect the diversity of the city, but you know how the media is, and you know how others, the rest can be incredibly critical. If he doesn't hit 50% and he hits 35%, you know, diversity or 40% diversity, I feel like he's going to be harshly criticized. I think if he has a cabinet that's 40% diverse, I think that would be fantastic. So that would be better than most of the places that we work in, right?
Right.
And so I worry that, and just like in Ginn's article, I mean, he said, I'm going to make key appointments before, you know, before I come into office. He hasn't done that. So now, you know, the media is hounding him every week. Where are your key appointments? Where are your key appointments?
And sometimes I think it's best if people just don't say when they're going to name, because that might make it easier. So then when you name them, you name them. If you're just tuning in, this is Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, and we're peering into our crystal ball, imagining the future of Boston's business, culture, and politics. I'm Callie Crossley, and here with me is Marcella Garcia of Telemundo Boston. I'm also a contributor to the Boston Business Journal and the Boston Globe, Ginn Dumschus of the Dorchester Reporter, and Shirley Leong of the Boston Globe. So if we understand that these appointments and business are drivers in moving us to whatever the next evolution is of the new Boston. One of the things that I think is critically important, and we're living this with the big snowstorm last week, transportation, Shirley. Let's talk about transportation, because I got to say, without public transportation, I just would have been, you know, by the side of the road. So this is critically important to me to be able to get around. And I'm a little peon in terms of what other people who really rely on these systems to get to work and to keep sort of this city going. Again, I'm interested in hearing from you what you understand from the mayor-elect about where the emphasis is, where his emphasis is on the issue of transportation. And then I'm going to have Shirley come in and add something to that.
I mean, there's no question that, public transportation is a big issue for Boston, and also traffic and congestion. I mean, I think Mayor Menino has said that in his waning days in office, that he wished he had done a better job, dealing with congestion here in the city. Walsh on the campaign trail talked about, going to Beacon Hill and, teaming up with other neighboring cities to ask for more money for the T.
Outside of Boston, those folks, those lawmakers, don't seem to be impressed by it. That's the bottom line, right?
Yes, they feel like Boston gets already too much money, but Boston is a nerve center for the rest of the state, and their constituents come into Boston to work. So they need a Boston. Those lawmakers need a Boston that works very well and moves people around more effectively. So so we'll see if Walsh is able to rally his fellow mayors in the surrounding communities to get more money from the state to have a better T. Just look at the Seaport District itself. I mean, it congestion threatens to choke the growth down there. The Silver Line is old and inadequate. There is a plan to bring rail to the Seaport District in the next couple years. I think that will go a long way to help ease congestion down there. Some other big ticket items include the expansion overhaul South Station. That's something that Marty Walsh will have to deal with as well. But he's in a tricky situation in that, the city, relies heavily on the T, but he doesn't control the T, the state does. So all he can do is kind of use his influence to get more money and to fix our transportation issues.
Yeah, but again, he has less money. He's got $50 million
yes.
less to start out with, Ginn. What are you hearing from him in terms of, or can you assess where his priorities have to be in some of these big ticket items?
Well, I think he comes at it from kind of as a Boston rep. He's very familiar with the MBTA, and he's had to deal with it on a constituent service basis. when, you know, the Ashmont trolley screeching into the station in a residential neighborhood. And he came into office as the new red line stations in Dorchester, Mattapan were being built. So he's familiar with the T, and I think he knows he has to work with the transportation officials to ensure that's going to happen. He's also coming into office as the MBTA is testing out a 3 a.m. Pilot program, running the trains until 3 a.m. So, I mean, I imagine he'll be pretty involved in that. I think because of his familiarity with the agency already, he's going to be pretty prepared for that. In terms of priorities, I think he does realize how much communities need public transportation to thrive. He's been at these meetings, and I think he knows what to focus on, and also the public hearings he's having as well. That'll bring up some priorities for him as well.
So far, I've not been paying as close attention to those hearings. Did the question or the issue of transportation come up over and over again?
I did not go to the transportation focus one. I believe those hearings are stretching into the end of January as well, so they're ongoing. But it's a good question of just you know, how much of a focus is it going to be? I think for commuters, for young professionals, for people who work late and have to get home at, you know, or come home at 4 a.m. In the morning, that's going to be key, and hopefully their voices are being heard, not just the young professionals.
Well, something
Chris Perrone, I'm sorry to interrupt, Callie, mm-hmm. but Chris Perrone of the Dig had a pretty good recap of those meetings, and it was a good read in the sense that the voice of the youth apparently was missing a little bit.
Mm.
So it was a very interesting read in that sense. If you missed the those meetings, you should read that article by Chris Ferrone at the Dig.
That's Marcela Garcia, special correspondent at Telemundo Boston, referring me to Chris Ferrone's articles in the Dig about the missing voice of the youth. And, you know, actually that ties together a number of issues that all of you have raised that could be problematic in terms of Boston's being able to move to the next level. I didn't speak about it with Malia Lazu, but Future Boston Alliance has been on this from the beginning, and that's about housing for folks as a way of retaining certainly young populations here, young talented populations here in Boston. And that's a big issue. And as you've written about, Shirley, there is a growing gap now so that there's very little middle class housing. So if you're poor, maybe you can get some subsidization. If you're rich, all the new development, all that big development, a lot of that BRA sponsored stuff is luxury housing. But for middle class folks, which, you know, are the glue for many communities, they're getting squeezed out. And this is a big problem. If you can't retain this young talent, then I'd like to know from all of you, what does this say about Marty Welsh or anybody else's ability to move us to the next level? Shirley, why don't you start?
Yeah, I mean, this is an issue. I feel like Marty Welsh can make one of his legacies. You know, I don't know how long he'll stay as mayor, but I mean, I think this should be a goal, and he's uniquely qualified to address it. I mean, he knows the development community really well because he was on the Labor Council. I feel like what needs to happen is that he needs to create some incentives for developers to build middle-class housing. I mean, the fact of the matter is, I mean, why do we have so much luxury housing here? It's because that's what developers can afford to build. I mean, land is so expensive here. Labor is so expensive here. In order to make the numbers work, you have to charge $500,000 for a condo. And that's just the average price, you know, for a condo. A lot of condos here in the downtown go for much higher, and that is out of a price point for a lot of people in Boston. And so I think Marty should work with, you know, developers. He should work with the city, you know, find creative ways, innovative ways to incentivize, I guess, middle-class housing in the city.
And can you ever move, Marcela, to be a world-class city if you don't have a young, vibrant population of talented folks who want to live, who are here? Yeah.
That's exactly why people live. They end up leaving Boston because they can't afford the rising rent. And let's also not forget about the other end of the spectrum. Pardon me for referring again to that piece by Chris Perron, but it's an interesting point that he makes in terms of housing. Absolutely what Shirley Leung says is true. We seem to be seeing an endless number of luxury condos available in the city, and the middle class is being squeezed out. But you know, what about those folks that are still facing foreclosures and are going to be evicted? So, again, there's that other side as well. I think those risks are going to go up. You know, they have to. You know, so that's something also to be watching.
Again, Shirley referred to Marty's experience in going to the meetings and working with the development community and understanding it. But he has an even more personal connection to middle-class housing, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah, he grew up in a three-decker in Dorchester on Taft Street. But I think he also sees it in his staff who worked on his campaign, who are right now trying to figure out, you know, if they want to join the administration. You know, a good number of them live outside the city, and they're struggling to see, you know, can I move into the city? What can I afford? And I think he's watching.
And wait a minute, again, are they living outside the city because they can't afford to live in Boston?
I think that's part of it. I think some of them moved out years ago because they were priced out, or they sought other jobs or school systems. And now if they want to work for the guy they helped elect, they have to figure out, how am I going to afford it? And which schools am I going to send my children to?
Just to be clear, Marty has made clear that he is going to maintain the rule that folks that work for him in City Hall and for city government have to live in the city of Boston. There is a housing requirement. And you were just listening to Gen Dumschus, who's a news editor at the Dorchester Reporter. Gen, what do you think absolutely has to happen in terms of some of the big ticket issues, and there are many, but we've talked about middle class housing, we've talked about transportation. Is there something else that will stop us from being the world class city we need to be, or we have an opportunity now with new leadership to address that's critically important?
I think pre-kindergarten is a big deal. The New York City is also focusing on this with the new mayor, Bill de Blasio, and it's something that Marty Walsh talked about on the trail there. Education overall. I mean, he needs to pick a superintendent, and that search is going to probably take the longest out of all of them, because it's such an important job, and he wants to have a nationwide search.
I should also mention, just because people need to know this, there really aren't that many superintendents of a certain caliber lying around. You know, I mean, there are very few of them in the nation, period. And lots of other cities are competing for them. In fact, when Marty was here doing an interview with me and Emily Rooney, he mentioned that the competition is fierce for even the small number of candidates. And then you have to make certain that somebody who sort of gets Boston, if you will. So this is a tough task.
Yeah, I mean, he's got a tall order. I think he's going to have to. He's been a state legislator for 16 years, and I think right now he is kind of experiencing something akin to culture shock, because you go from being one out of 160 people up on the Hill legislating to the number one guy in charge. You have all the levers at your disposal, and it's a lot of power. It's a lot to take in. Every time I've seen him since the election, he seems like he's still processing all of it.
Well, but he doesn't have much time to process it, Shirley. I mean, even though
he has a few more days,
even though people have said that, you know, he is the person who should take his time and do all of that. He really has to juggle four or five sort of huge issues at once as he takes the reign of the city, whether or not he has people in place. He's just got to, right?
Yeah, he has to. I mean, I think a chief of staff would appointing that person will go a long way and help out a lot. Right now he's got all these. I mean, it seems like an army in his at work in the transition team. But I feel like on Monday, tomorrow, when he becomes the mayor, I mean, people want more transparent, want some transparency. I mean, suddenly, you know. It can't be, you know, whatever, hundreds working on a transition team. We want to know who's in charge besides Marty. And so I'd like to see some of those appointments happen fairly quickly. I mean, one of the issues I think that, to go back to your question, Callie, about what would make us a city that works better. I mean, one perennial issue from the business community is to streamline permitting and regulations. For all the kind of economic growth that has happened under Menino, I mean, one complaint you hear all the time is how hard it is to open a small business in Boston. There are just too many hoops to jump through. A colleague of mine wrote this terrific piece about an example of what it takes to open up a restaurant in Boston. It takes you have to get permits and licenses. It costs all this money, and it's spread across a dozen different agencies. But if you go to Chicago, you just go to one office and you can get all your permits in one place, and I think it costs $600.
Yeah. So, you're absolutely right about this. This came up so many times at the mayoral forum I moderated, and this was an issue that just burned up people. They were so angry about it and so frustrated. And as one guy said, listen, aside from all of the frustrating steps, then it's very costly. So by the time you're done, where's your money to invest in your business?
And there was also a feeling you had to know someone to open a business in Boston. I mean, you have to be politically connected, and that just doesn't seem right. I mean, if someone wants to, if there's a small business entrepreneur out there who wants to risk their, own capital in opening, a business in the city of Boston, we shouldn't make it hard for them. We should make it very easy to open, a business in Boston.
Well, I will say this, that Malia Lazu referred to a big community conversation, and I believe that Marty is trying to do that with these small group meetings around the city and state. And a lot of folks have suggested strongly that people who want to be heard be there, so that the emphasis, as he looks over the many things that he has to pick out to do, he can decide what needs to get his attention first. So, and that's the most direct way you can get your city government to work at this point, right?
Right.
Jen, last word from you.
Well, I think we head into tomorrow with a lot of question marks about kind of what the next few weeks hold. Hopefully we'll know pretty soon what his administration will look like. And until then, I guess that tomorrow will be a celebration of the start of a new era.
And when you say tomorrow, you're really referring to Monday. Our show airs on Sunday, so that'll be good. Yeah, so that'll be great. It'll be Monday, and we'll see what happens after that. Thank you all.
Thank you, Callie.
Thank you, Marcella Ginn and Shirley. Marcella Garcia is a special correspondent at Telemundo Boston and a contributing writer for the Boston Business Journal and the Boston Globe. Ginn Dumschus is news editor at the Dorchester Reporter. And Shirley Leung is a business columnist and associate editor at the Boston Globe. Coming up, Lanyap, our Something Extra segment. You can also hear Boston's future. Spanish language speakers are shaping 6 Boston area dialects into a language with unique characteristics. Next, a closer look at this phenomenon first reported by WGBH's Ann Mastu. You're listening to Under the Radar. I'm Callie Crossley.